Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Well, only a few more weeks left, but ever since March, we have begun this show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. That was the time when he assured his father it would be all right, speaking truth to power. What we found out was that it was not all right for him, it was not all right for his twin brother, and frankly, it's not all right for us. The testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Before we bring in our first guest, I have to comment on the beginning of the hearing of Amy Coney Barrett. Obviously, it's somewhat of a slam dunk. Donald Trump has what he needs. Mitch McConnell controlling the U.S. Senate. Lindsey Graham doing the bidding of the president. But as I was listening to the testimony, everyone, what was brought up by the Democrats over and over again is what is the potential of her appointment to the Affordable Care Act. And as someone who began her political career because of healthcare, because of lack of access to health insurance, who actually ran on some sort of variation on single payer when she ran for governor in 1992, I just wanted to comment a little bit about pre-existing conditions. I wanted to become the governor of New Hampshire, maybe for one very important reason. I wanted to testify before Congress when Hillary Clinton was talking about Hillary Care. And that was because while I was running for governor, I lost my health insurance. And I found out that my husband had dropped our health insurance when I called him up to tell him that I had a lump in my breast. And I said, I need to get a mammogram. And he said, you can't. And I said, what do you mean I can't? He said, I dropped our health insurance. And if you go and get a mammogram, you may end up with a pre-existing condition and the family will never be able to access health insurance. So I lost the race for governor, finally went and got a mammogram after we'd been reinsured. And the doctor asked me, when did you feel the lump? And I said, about 6 months ago. And he said, why didn't you come in 6 months ago? And I said, because I didn't have health insurance. And he said, oh, Arnie, you could have afforded a mammogram. And then I turned to the doctor and the nurse and I said, but I couldn't afford the answer because what if you found cancer? That was Arnie Arneson running for governor in the state of New Hampshire. The Affordable Care Act is so important to so many people. That's just one piece of it. Think about that as we move forward into this election. Think about that as Amy Coney Barrett appears on the court as they look to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
So Sunday was coming out day, and I read a just wonderful piece at my Facebook post. And of course, it didn't surprise me because Chloe Lacasse is someone who I've come to know. She is the producer of my Best of the Attitude show. She is a friend. And as I was reading her coming out piece, I realized I needed to reach out to her. I wanted her to share what she wrote with the audience. And I wanted to also personalize this. You know, we talk about these issues as if it's someone else or someone we don't know. But in fact, it is people we know. It's people we love. And as I was reading Chloe's piece, I happened to grab an article from the Washington Post. And the article, it was an opinion piece, was entitled, Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation would be an LGBTQ rights emergency. And in a way, I started to cry. Because I thought we were moving forward. And then the potential of what Amy Coney Barrett could mean to the Supreme Court
would mean that we'd be moving backwards. And that is not good for the country. It's not good for the Velcro of how we hold ourselves together as a society. And it wouldn't be good for Chloe Lacasse. So given that article, I wanted to invite Chloe on to read her piece that she had written on Facebook about her coming out, and also then to connect it to my concerns about Judge Barrett. Because I think in a lot of ways, we've always seen that we've moved this country to a greater understanding of what is equality. You know, they use the words in the Declaration of Independence, they use the words in the Constitution, but they kind of were winking and nodding because they didn't necessarily mean what they wrote. But they were all basically, I think, in some ways, hoping that the future would be a real definition of equality. So let me welcome to the program, Chloe. How are you, Chloe Lacasse?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. This is fascinating, being on the other side of the microphone. Normally, I'm editing your show for Saturday mornings, and it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, it is a pleasure. So tell my audience a little bit about you, and then go to your Facebook post and read it to them. It was powerful. It was emotional. I'm going to share it on our Facebook post for The Attitude. And you also posted the before and after picture of Chloe. And as I was saying to you before, I had never seen you before
right.
the Chloe I know. So to see the before Chloe and the Chloe I have come to love and know was like, wow. But as I said to you, I have a friend who's 100 years old. When I see her when she's 21 with her red hair and her Spitfire and her fencing outfit on, I'm going, oh my God, she had red hair? You know, it's like that, it's always been you. And now I get to sort of know you. So welcome to the program and explain to us a little bit about yourself and then share with my audience your Facebook post.
Yeah, thank you. So I came out in 2016, I'm trans, and that photo juxtaposition is a favorite of mine. I have a couple photos from back when, and of course, you know, juxtaposed to modern photos. And people are taken off their feet by that sort of, that difference, because so much of who we are, I would go so far as to say, like, one of the foundational principles that humanity and society places on us is that you are a boy or you are a girl. And with those delineations comes a whole host of rules and, more importantly, exclusions. If you're a boy, you are excluded from a lot more things than you think. And as a woman, obviously, as feminism, the waves of feminism have crossed over the years, the same rule applies. That being raised as a woman, you have infinitely less access to things that men take for granted. So for me, you know, I lived for about 44 years of my life, completely, I don't want to say oblivious to being trans, but it was there, it was closeted quite literally. And so it was something that came out in my private time. I didn't dare tell anybody. It was full of shame and fear because let's be honest, you know, to boil down what it means to be a man is basically masculinity is, in essence, the absence of femininity. And the way I interpret that is that masculinity does everything in its power to seek and destroy, to crush any semblance of softness, warmness, compassion, empathy, because boys are taught at a very, very young age that to be soft and to be feminine is to be gay, to be queer, to be weak. to be substandard as a boy. And these sort of gender straitjackets, as you know, as I've learned to call them, a friend of mine coined that phrase. And it's so apt because it really does speak to the evolution of us as little boys and little girls. So with all of that, you know, I went through my life, I worked in construction, I worked in film and video, I worked, you know, in a lot of different, professions over the course of my life, but all along, I was trying to be somebody that I simply wasn't. I just was not this tough, rough and tumble, cool cucumber guy. So, you know, when I did come out in 2016, I fell into the trans non-discrimination campaign that was going on here in New Hampshire. It took us two passes at that bill, but we did win it in 2018, bipartisan bill. I know that's hard to fathom these days that anything would be done bipartisan, but you know, it happened. And New Hampshire is very lucky to be one of the 30 states that has transgender non-discriminations. So
let me just stop you there for a second, because again,
I have a love-hate relationship with my state. I also have a love-hate relationship with the concept of being a libertarian. But there is something very important sometimes about the libertarian aspect of my state. And I've said this over and over again, that we don't necessarily embrace big church and we don't necessarily embrace big government. But it also means that it explains why New Hampshire was the first state in the nation to legislatively embrace gay marriage. It didn't need a court. It didn't need the Supreme Court. It didn't do what Massachusetts did with their decision, which was driven by the Massachusetts Supreme Court. It did it legislatively. So as you are describing what happened as it being a bipartisan thing, when it sort of embraced the concept of transgender rights, it doesn't surprise me, because there is this interesting thing that is a Velcro that can hold a liberal Democrat with a libertarian Republican. And it's kind of interesting. And in a lot of ways, I've seen it play out in my state. So what you are describing is something that I want people to understand. There is an opportunity for us to bridge build. Sometimes we do back into each other. We may be coming in on different roads, but we end up finding a place of agreement. So I just want to sort of comment on that, because the bipartisan aspect of it is something I celebrate about living in New Hampshire.
Yeah, definitely. I you know, it's interesting, you know, different folks come to conclusions, and sometimes they are the same conclusion in different ways. It's similar to, you know, you and I both having a casserole recipe, and, you know, both of our casseroles are tuna casseroles and they're both delicious. However, we prepared them a little bit differently. So I think, yeah, in that way, I think that's, you know, that those discussions that we have, if they are allowed to happen, and unfortunately today we don't allow those things to happen in so many ways, people just want to drown out the other. But yeah, turning back to sort of my coming out. So, you know, of course, for 44 years, I never celebrated anything, pride, gay, the flag, anything. So when I did, it was just an incredibly awesome experience. And so every year since, on National Coming Out Day, I and a lot of my friends, gay, trans, non-binary and otherwise, have all posted things saying, hey, some people post photos, some people just post commentary. I like to do both because the changes are so dramatic. And I'm more than happy to read it to you.
And before you do, I know you mentioned to me that your mother was visiting you.
She's still here, actually, yeah.
She's still here, okay. Yeah. Hi, Mom.
Hello, Mom.
So the reason I asked that question is when you came out, I mean, you were in your 40s.
Yeah.
How did your mother react? Did your mother sort of say, was shocked? Or did your mother kind of know?
She didn't know. She was really clueless, because I was the model of a man. I was very artistic looking. I looked like a musician, an artist. You know, I had a very certain look. And so, you know, for everybody, they just, you know, this is... there he is, you know, nobody thought anything. And, you know, and that's what's really wild, is that when I released myself, you know, my true self, when I discovered her and I started giving her, you know, the time of day and breaths of fresh air and, you know, listened for the first time in my life at 44. And she said, no, let's go. This is what I want to do. And I was like, oh, okay. And so we went, and it was I used Facebook for good instead of evil. And sort of, you know, use that platform as a matter of just, you know, here I am. I went from a very apathetic and, you know, I don't want to say silent person on Facebook, but, you know, my profile was pretty dry. And then all of a sudden I was here, I was there, I was different people, I looked amazing. And just so the story went. So through Facebook, my mom and my weekly phone calls, my mom learned about what was going on. And she was very confused at first. Like, you know, many, many parents will tell the story about their child coming out, no matter the age. And so basically it was one of these things where, you know, Facebook just sort of was that digital vehicle where I sort of showed the world what was going on.
Yeah, Ken.
Can I ask you, Chloe, you said a minute ago that you discovered her and you released your true self. How did you discover her? What made you start looking for her? How did that transition happen? You know, that particular, the mental transition of even thinking about looking for her.
Great. That's a great question. you know, she had been there since I was 4 or 5 years old. And, you know, I was the firstborn. I was the oldest by 5 years. So there was a lot of time I had to my mom and I had together. And I wanted to be her. I mean, I adored her. I still do. And so it was there. And, but of course, you know, the words didn't exist back in the early 70s. Yeah. So, you know, any display or desire to display wearing mom's clothes or, you know, wanting to grow my hair longer or anything, we're quietly and thoughtfully put away. Like, no, that's not for you. That's for mommy. And so, you know, those words and those actions as a young child, you know, as thoughtful as they were, I mean, they carry so much weight. So, you know, she was buried in the back of the closet under, you know, piles of clothes and under boxes and just sort of lost to time. And, you know, every now and then when you were alone and, you know, in those hours, you know, between, you know, 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. when you're sort of staring out at the universe going, what's next? Why me? What's this all about? Those things did cross my mind, but they were so masculinity and the binary programming, that heteronormative programming, that's a big word, but really control what we think. I mean, how can you, I have a meme on the top of my Facebook page. It says, if you live in a box, you can't dream of the stars the same way as someone who actually sees the sky. And so much of what we are told we are dictates what we will see and what we will appreciate. So that, you know, that was something that just carried over through the years,
Let me just stop you there for a second, uh-huh. because what you're told you are is what you see.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking about this country and how we have sort of whitewashed our history.
Yeah.
And how we have eliminated so many pieces of who we really are. Mm-hmm. And if you're being limited in that storytelling, then it actually limits what you see as right or wrong, what you see as the challenges that need to be addressed. And what you are saying isn't just about Chloe. It isn't about just finding the female who you are. It really is a description of all of us. So in some ways, what you were able to do to sort of find yourself and to be honest about who you were is what this country has got to do.
It
we
is.
Have to find ourselves. We have to be honest about who we are. And isn't it fascinating to me that it's my trans friend who explains to me what we need to do as a nation, because you have done it as an individual. And now the question is, can we do it collectively? Because I think it's so important, and that honesty is good for us as much as it was good for you.
I cannot agree with that statement more. You know, so much of who we are, and again, in my case, my journey has been gender and challenging all of those norms. But as I've moved forward from that moment of discovery and incorporated that same sort of mathematical formula, if you will, I'm from Massachusetts. Every now and then my accent comes back. If you take that formula, you can apply that to literally everything we exactly. are suffering from, because in so many ways, the very binary that creates and dictates who we are create and dictate the society we live in. Everything is binary. Good, evil, up, down, wet, dry, you know, Republican, Democrat. Everything is a polar opposite to the other. And we have lost that middle ground. But yet the middle ground is really where, you know, everybody lives, and we forget that. So it's a brilliant observation. Thank you for pointing that out.
All right. So I want you to go where I was going to start,
I know.
Which was your Facebook post. And again, I want to remind everyone that it isn't just about what happened on Sunday with coming out. It is my concern about what Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation will mean for LGBTQ rights. And we got to hear Chloe and look at this confirmation hearing, and we have to tie them together. They are not separate. They are part of who we are. And then the question is, how do we address this changing Supreme Court, and whether maybe Amy Coney Barrett can hear the Chloes of this world and understand how it makes us a better and more equal and more just country. All right, read your piece, madame.
Thank you. So here it goes. So my coming out was in so many ways an accident. I had long since bought into the binary construct, and for over 40 years was just along for the ride. I molded myself a cool cucumber, walking in chucks, and from all outward appearances, seemingly not giving an F. After all, I was everything a man was supposed to be, confident yet aloof, cocky yet humorous, and disarming enough to get backstage without a pass. And where I could command a room even then, I was as lost and lonely as a soul could be. For all the privilege and potential I was gifted on behalf of my assigned gender, I was this miserable man who felt like he was living outside of time and space. Everything inside me conflicted with this cool and ultimately grizzled exterior. In short, I never really knew who I was. Instead, I was acting out a pre-recorded set of instructions. I had been so thoroughly convinced that all of the world's femininity was not only external to me, but I was forbidden to possess these qualities in myself. Instead, it was on me to beg, borrow, and steal with the hope of finding a woman who would see and affirm this carefully constructed doppelganger in his full masculinized form. And for decades, life drummed on as I forever wandered aimlessly trying to fulfill for another that which I was not. That was until a series of three consecutive relationships back from 2014 to 16 opened me, imploded me, and nursed me back from the brink of an emotional death. As the smoke lifted and I found myself searching through the ashes of him, it's where I discovered her. She had been so expertly wrapped away in shame and fear that her voice had always been too weak to hear clearly, nor confident enough to be believed if I had. Yet there she was, the only remaining piece of everything I had ever been, or so I thought. She was everything I had always dreamed of in a woman, and here she was with her arm outstretched to mine. So as I grasped her hand and held her up, she began to speak, and those words had changed my life forever. Quote, I knew one day you'd find me, for I'm the things that you were told you could never feel, for I'm all the things you were told you could never process. I was all the things you were told you could never be, for I am you and you've always been me. To those who have just come out and who are afraid to come out or just aren't ready to come out, we all see you. And please know that you have worth beyond your wildest dreams. And we look forward to welcoming you home when you make that choice.
I wish that what you just read was read to Amy Coney Barrett. You know, with her children behind her, because I want her children to hear you. You know, my children have been the greatest gift to me, but they've also been the greatest teachers to me. And Ken has heard me tell this story about us being in the 60-minute special called Faith in Politics with Dan Rather in 1995. And my little kids, they were little, they were like 10, 11 years old, were sitting in the bed watching it because we were part of the special. And there was a part of the special where they went to Texas and it was a group of gay folks committing themselves inside of a church. This is 1995, so long before gay marriage. And outside these churches, there were this sort of commitment ceremonies with these gay couples or people burning crosses, driving pickup trucks, you know, hooting and hollering with Confederate flags and guns. And they were outside the church. These people were inside the church, basically expressing their love publicly to people inside the church. And at the end of the special, I'll never forget this, Chloe. I turned to my daughters and I said, how'd we do? You know, like I want to know how our segment was. And it was my youngest daughter, Kirsten, who said, I want to go to the Texas segment, Mommy. And I said, well, about what? And she says, why does anyone hate anyone for loving someone? For loving someone. Why would anyone not understand a Chloe?
The Chloe.
What you wrote is so important. And in a lot of ways, having you testify to that in front of Amy Coney Barrett isn't just testifying to a potential Supreme Court justice. It's testifying to America. Because you are who we want to be. You are the honesty we want to be. You are the equality we want to be. And that's why as I read this Washington Post opinion piece, and believe it or not, it was written by Jim Obergefell, who was the decision that allows gay marriage. Okay, the Supreme Court decision. Yeah. He wrote it, okay, knowing what this opinion could mean. I mean, this confirmation of this justice could mean. So I just feel like in a lot of ways, we need to make people hear people. And what you wrote on Facebook was something that needed to be heard, not just because it applied to folks who are coming out, because in a lot of ways it liberates all of us to come out. You know, we don't always come out on gender. We come out on a lot of things. Yeah. And it's an invitation for us to come out. And also, again, as I said to you before, It allows us to come out on the mistakes we've made as a nation, come out as the mistakes we've made as a society. And if you can recognize those mistakes and admit them, not only can you move forward, but you can fix things. But unless you acknowledge it, you can't.
You cannot, no. And I think politics aside, if we just take the human experience, so much of what we are given as children, for good or for bad, we spend the rest of our lives defending. And if it's an honorable and thoughtful and, you know, well-educated position, you know, it makes sense. But oftentimes, unfortunately, the way the world works, not everybody gets access to those types of parents, those types of situations, those types of caregivers, schools, you know, and colleges. And unfortunately, we end up defending. You know, I was defending a position of masculinity my entire life simply because I knew nothing different. It was what it was. This is the world and this is the path I shall walk. And I'm miserable. That's just the way it is. And looking back now, I feel so sad. I have so much compassion for that person because he didn't know. He didn't know there was so much infinite potential in the human capacity to love, to grow, to go beyond that which I thought was real. And, you know, I would say that does work here with this, that does correspond with, you know, politics of the day, the confirmation or not of Amy. And, you know, in the future of just what we call, you know, the United States of America, what happens after November 3rd? Where do we go from here?
And that is the great question. And I need to let you go. And I am so glad I grabbed you. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. That was Chloe Lacoste. She is my Best of the Attitude producer. She is my friend. And I just want to warn everyone that we have a fabulous interview next, but we had so many Zoom problems between my sound and the Zoom connection failing on us, but we have to do this interview. The title of the piece was Fox News Uses the Word Hate Much More Than MSNBC or CNN. We interview Professor Robert Entman from George Washington University. Pay attention, get through the bad sound sometimes of me, but this is one of the most frightening and compelling interviews we've done. I will link you to the article, read the article, share the article, but pay attention to Robert Entman. This is important to us and to our future. There is something wrong with Fox. And it's not that they're conservative. It is far beyond that. All right, everyone, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. We'll be right back. Opinions came to be king, and knowledge lost its value. Are you taking a daily dose of assertive conditioning? Is tough, so tough. Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Tuesday edition. I saw the headline, again, another article from The Conversation. You can tell I'm a real junkie for theconversation.com. And the title of the article did not surprise me. Perhaps the intensity of certain words is somewhat shocking. Fox News uses the word hate much more than MSNBC or CNN. And I'm thinking, well, of course. And then I read the article.
Much more is an understatement.
The level of use and the intensity of use was mind-blowing.
Let me grab our second guest, Robert Matthews Entman. He is a professor emeritus of media and public affairs at George Washington University. And he and his fellow author, Kurt Neupfer, wrote this piece where they analyzed the different sort of cable stations, in particular MSNBC and Fox, because they're sort of at the opposite ends of the spectrum, I suspect, Professor Entman. But tell us a little bit about what you looked at, the words you chose to look at, and based on this information that you sort of were able to glean, what you think this means for both the audience and what it actually means for both our country and for the democratic institutions we want to protect. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. That's a few questions, and let me start out with describing how this arose. We started out wanting to compare Fox and MSNBC in their coverage of the impeachment and the COVID pandemic. And then in the course of that, it requires scholars to read a lot of transcriptions of Fox and MSNBC news programs. And it just jumped out at us that the word hate was coming up very frequently on Fox and hardly at all on MSNBC. And if you drill a little deeper, you see who they're talking about doing the hating and who's being hated. And that's where you say you're not surprised by this. I was surprised. I because of the particular way they use hate on Fox, they emphasize that people on the left hate everyone on the right. And
well, let me just say something. If you want to create an enemy, that's what they're doing. I am not the opposition. I'm not the political opposition. I'm not someone that you just vote for. I am the enemy. I live in New Hampshire, where we had a Speaker of the House and a Republican Majority Leader who talked about mounting the parapets, who talked about the language they used was the language of war. The language they used was the language of an enemy. And in order to sort of cultivate that kind of emotional response, you have to say hate and you have to direct it at me. I must be the one that hates you in order for you to hate me. And I think that's one of the reasons why maybe it's my New Hampshire libertarian Republican Uber experience, but I could see it happening. And then I see the echo chamber of Fox just reinforcing it.
Yeah, of course, with the relationship between the Republican Party and Fox these days, it's hard to say, chicken or egg on these.
Yeah.
But it is certainly clear that this is a commercial as well as political strategy for Fox. That is, it's a great way to maintain the arousal of the audience emotionally by telling them they are under siege from the entire establishment outside of the conservative establishment. So they construct these two communities, Fox does. There's the community of us and we're the real Americans. We connect to the true values of this country. And then these people who reject the true values of the country. But not only that, actually hate you, the Fox viewer. And so
right.
Yeah.
And one of the things I want people to know the words that you looked at. So
yes.
You talked about these different terms, these negative terms, dislike, despise, can't stand, and hate. I'm familiar with these words. But then you actually drilled down on hate. And let me just pull a nugget out because I actually put this on my Facebook page just because I wanted people to see this nugget. And what you wrote is, we expected to find that both of the strongly ideological networks made use of such words, perhaps in different ways. Instead, we found that Fox used antipathy words five times more often than MSNBC. But this is where I think you were shocked. Hate really stood out. It appeared 647 times on Fox compared to 118 times on MSNBC. So you look for like a couple of month period, you look between 6 p.m. and 11 p.m. at night on both of these stations, and you actually counted the use of the words, and you saw just an overwhelming drumbeat of the use of the word hate.
That's correct. And importantly, who is allegedly being hated? And as I say, overwhelmingly, it's allegedly the people who watch Fox, who are completely established as a community in their desire to worship, essentially, Trump. So they're constantly saying the object of hate is either Trump or it's you. And there's really no difference between you and Trump. So you are united in being reviled, despised, disliked. Allegedly, the liberals and the media and Democrats can't stand you. And as you said, this really creates the sense of an enemy. There's really nothing more arousing of hatred than to be told the other guy hates you. Then you're going to hate him back.
And doesn't Trump actually uses the word that, you know, the press is the enemies of the people, Democrats are the enemies of the people, Obama's and Biden are the enemies of the people, right? And Fox does too. It's
enemies.
They use the word. It's not just the implication.
Yes, that's right. They do say that. But what's important is that they direct it right at you, the Fox viewer. And they do this every night. This is part of their, almost you could say, it's like a slogan, like they used to say, we're fair and balanced. Almost that much, they say, they hate you.
Yeah. So I have the article in front of me, and as we're talking, I am looking at the graph you did from 2011 to 2020. And I'm going to recommend, Robert, that this somehow, this graph has to get into everybody's hands. It just has to. Because what is so shocking about the graph is that, you know, they did use these sort of negative hate words from 2011 through 2016. Then Trump gets elected. And you see CNN and Fox almost pairing a little bit for about a year on the use of the word hate. And then CNN and MSNBC tanked, and Fox News goes off the freaking charts. It is unbelievable, the level of banging of the hate drum. And again, this is the echo chamber. They were given the license and the encouragement and almost the demand by the President of the United States to constantly use the word, because it reinforced, at least in his mind, his ability to control the agenda and to ultimately think that he could control the elector.
Yeah, as I said, Fox is essentially part of the marketing arm of the Trump campaign. And this is central to Trump's, way of selling himself, that I'm the one politician you can trust who loves you. And they, that is Democrats, liberals, they hate you. And, you know, the famous phrase that people say about the First Amendment, there is a certain limit on the First Amendment, and that is shouting fire in a crowded theater, right?
Right.
Well, if you think about American politics today with militia and, various forms of violence that are sometimes mysterious as to who's really doing it and so on, not to mention the literal violence that's happening, this is like shouting fire in the crowded tinderbox theater of American politics. This is creating, truly intense inflammatory rhetoric and injecting it into people nightly, you know, on the most popular news network. Yeah, I was just going to say, okay, you know, the next question might be, well, maybe Democrats and liberals and the media do hate people on the right. So maybe this is just an accurate reminder of the conditions. Well, of course, political scientists have studied this, although not in quite the detail that I would like. But to the extent that they have studied negative emotions on both sides, Republicans arguably have a little more negative emotions towards Democrats than vice versa. But for sure, negative emotions towards each other in this polarized time has increased. This is accurate. But the thing is, the left, assuming they're watching MSNBC, aren't getting these claims. In fact, MSNBC never once in four about 4 1/4 months that we looked at this, told their viewers that conservatives hate liberals. Now, I submit to you, something's going on there. And one thing is that MSNBC is not relying in the same way on stirring up people's emotions to keep them glued to the set. It's more rational. So there is
let me ask you a couple of questions, because you're the media god in this conversation. And there's a couple of things I'm thinking about. And that is that Fox has changed since Donald Trump got elected, because your graph shows it has changed. And when you look at the graph, you realize, you know, who's feeding who, I'm not quite sure. But when you realize that Trump demands the use of hate, Fox understands the marketing of hate. Fox is doing incredibly well because it's a ratings god, because hate obviously is attractive. I mean, think of you teach journalism or media. When it bleeds, it leads. You know, we hate it, but we can't take our eyes off of it. And they know that. It's really, you know, it's hard to sell love and good stories. It's really great to sell sadistic stories and hate stories. And that's all that Donald Trump is selling, and that's all that Fox is selling. My question then becomes, can you put the genie back in the bottle? If this is what Fox has discovered with Trump, even if this election turns Trump out of office, where does Fox go with the hate they've sold?
Yeah, very interesting question, because right now it is sort of part of their DNA. It's a big part of their selling proposition. So I suspect that, you know, it'll be pretty easy for them to say, see, we told you, all these people are hating the real Americans, and somehow through cheating and so on, they managed to win this election. We have to take the country back. So I think they'll continue. It might be that Republicans will decide this isn't the best way to build a base without Trump, in which case maybe some of this rhetoric will cool, which would be very good for the country.
I want this graph not to go to every Republican, not to go to the Democrats who are like going, see, they have been preaching hate, we were right about this. I really want this graph that shows the hate just off the charts going to every advertiser. Because what this hate is promoting, and you even mentioned it, Robert, is that we're looking at what happened in Michigan. We're looking at places around the country where we're seeing this fomenting of secession and rebellion and unrest. And if you're an advertiser, do you want to advertise on a station that is basically adding more fuel to this fire? Because is that good for selling in the marketplace?
Yeah, I think in a broad sense, Fox should be a pariah of American journalism. And
yes.
I think it's really a shame that the rest of the media, the legitimate news organizations, treat them as if they are equivalent to MSNBC. Well, you know, they're the right-wing version and MSNBC is the left-wing version. They're not very similar at all. And that would mean, among other things, that respectable advertisers, particularly given what Fox is doing, as we've just been discussing, they're tearing this country apart. They're contributing to this terrible polarization. Respectable companies should not be advertising, and there should be a lot of pressure on them. Said we'll be seeing, you know, Tucker Carlson loses a few advertisers. That's not enough. It really should be something that no respectable company will advertise on. And of course, if that happens, guess what? Fox will have to change if they want to maintain their profitability.
I read your article as sort of the idea that they need to be shamed. this is important. In some ways, I almost want your article, I want you to go to every business school in the United States. And I want you to talk to everyone who teaches marketing and advertising. And I want you to go to the Rotary Clubs, the Chamber of Commerce, and show them this. Because if they want they need a stable economy, what do I keep getting from? That's what business wants. They want stability. They want to know how to operate. What you see with this graph that you have shown with Fox, what we have seen as a consequence of this hatred, is a level of instability we have never, ever embraced in this country. And they are constantly feeding it. And you're absolutely right. They are not like CNN.
They're not like MSNBC. They're not like any of these stations. And what they're doing is not just promoting a political agenda. They're actually creating a level of instability that is not good for their product and is not good for their company.
You know what? I think you should write an op-ed yourself with that argument, because I think that's exactly right. I would just add one thing. If you think about how so often on Fox, they devote time to saying, among other things, that the media, that is the mainstream media, hate you, real Americans, conservative Americans, et cetera. What should really be happening is some pressure from the left on Fox. And I don't understand why the Democratic Party doesn't do equivalent kind of referee playing to the way the conservatives put pressure on the mainstream media. Why aren't Democrats constantly denouncing Fox and media that follow them? Very importantly, Rush Limbaugh, who you mentioned, and talk radio, which is also very powerful. And although I haven't done the research, I would be willing to bet that you'd have very similar findings.
Look, I replaced, you're going to die when you hear this. I replaced Rush Limbaugh on five stations back in the like the early 2000s. I mean, it's a long story, but anyway, so I was on from 12 to 3, the rush hours, 5 days a week, you know, how many months of the year. Here's the interesting thing about that, Robert. Do you know what we didn't lose audience share? That they were tuned in. They were very angry in the beginning. But in the end, we developed a relationship. And well, it was about being there. It was about being there. And what I'm going to tell you is something that's going to get a lot of people angry. I love public radio. Let me just remind you, I love public radio. But you know what's happened as a result of public radio? There used to be diversity on the commercial dial. There used to be people like Arnie Arneson and Dr. Ruth and all those different voices. And there was lefties and conservatives. And there was diversity on the dial. Once public radio emerged, the diversity on the dial disappeared. We all sort of sheltered ourselves in place with public radio. And that left commercial radio for one thing and one thing alone. And that was conservative talk 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we never got to get reacquainted again. We never had to be on the same dial again. And then you look at what's happened with Fox and this graph that is totally depressing. And you have to, I totally agree with you. I think this story, you should be on Rachel Maddow. You should be on Chris Hayes. Not just once, but you need to be on almost every other week. Because I think this kind of shaming has to happen. And your numbers and your graphs reinforce that this is not MSNBC going after Fox. This is the world Fox has created.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I can't argue the point. I think it would be very important. And really, this is designed to get people thinking about what really is news and what is journalism and how Fox has really distorted that.
So can I ask how you would recommend that either the Academy, like yourselves, and getting the message out there, and how you all can somehow get to and ally with the MSNBC people, and I mean, even the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the non-Fox people out there, how do you create this kind of somehow, it's not so much shaming as standing up to Fox? You know, Fox is like the bully in the room, and they start shouting these hatred messages, and nobody says the emperor has no clothes. Nobody says that that's not what we human beings or we American human beings are about. What can be done?
What can be done is it's a long story, but let me just give one idea. For decades, the conservative establishment has created a myth that the media in general have a liberal bias. And This has been such an effective propaganda effort that even most journalists believe that. And certainly the vast majority of the American people believe it. Because of the pressure from the need to prove we at NBC, we at the Washington Post, et cetera, are not liberal. You know, we're totally down the middle, blah, blah, blah. In fact, they often bend over backwards.
Yes.
And an example of that was ridiculous email scandal for Hillary Clinton, which almost certainly is what cost her the presidency and cost this country you know, what Trump has done to the country. When you have those kinds of created fantasies and you have nothing, you know, you had the New York Times feeding that, the New York Times and the evening news of the traditional networks feeding that enormous amounts of coverage. I mean, by 20 to 1 over public policy issues and so on, what the election should have been about. Okay, so you have that situation. I think Fox is part of the intimidation of the rest of the media. They are afraid to label Fox for what it is, which is a propaganda organization designed to push Rupert Murdoch's conservative worldview and, of course, make him a ton of money. And that's all they care about. They have no interest in the traditional journalistic, you know, goals and values, and they should be treated as such. And yet the mainstream media are so intimidated that they sort of go very gently when they talk about Fox. They're afraid.
So, Robert, I got to ask you a question. How many people have called you to come on the air with them? How many people have repeated your story? The conversation.com gets picked up in different papers around the country. I'm kind of curious to know how many papers around the country picked this up. I'm kind of curious to know how many radio talk show hosts or TV talk show hosts called you to talk about your article. I'm getting angrier and more frightened by the minute, because I totally agree with what you said from your analysis. And I'm going to give you an example of what's happening right now. Right now, we're hearing the idea of the fact that Joe Biden has not responded to the question about the size of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I hear that over and over again, that he hasn't answered this question on CNN and MSNBC. This is at the same time as the President of the United States has not answered the question whether he will leave office if he loses the election.
Yes.
Now, I hate to break it to you, they're not even on the same planet.
Right.
The difference in those questions are so unbelievable, but yet because Joe Biden hasn't necessarily answered the question about the Supreme Court, I've heard that like 50 times, instead of being reminding everyone over and over and over again that neither Pence nor Trump have answered the question whether they will accept the loss.
Yeah, among other things, you could also answer that there is no one who has packed the courts like the Trump administration.
McConnell
deliberately kept open like 100 vacancies under Obama, and they've packed the court with right-wing extremists who are frequently not qualified.
But they've done that in a legal way. They haven't changed the structure of society. And frankly, that's another example, just like your media example, the Times being afraid and everybody else being afraid to go after the bully. You know, the Democrats, when in office, either with Clinton or Obama, have proposed judges in all aspects, the Supreme Court and the lower courts, who are more middle of the road in the hopes that it doesn't inflame the Republicans to complain about it. And Trump has no such compunctions about putting forward the most unqualified and reactionary people.
That's right. If they were distinguished.
All right, so I'm going to make a recommendation to you, Robert. And that is that this is an incredibly important story. It's an incredibly important story, and I have done this before, but I'm going to make the recommendation that you or the conversation.com send this out. This needs to get into the hands of Rachel Maddow. The graph especially, a picture paints a million words, and that graph from 2011 to 2020 that shows the use of hate just going through the roof on Fox is something that needs to be paid attention to and made aware of. And MSNBC is good at telling stories. They told the stories about what was happening in Flint, Michigan. You know, I mean, they know how to draw people's eyes to something. It is not only important that MSNBC recognize this, it will then give them maybe a stronger voice and a bigger spine to be able to respond to Fox. But people like the Arnies around the world and the different people around the world, they need to see it too, because they're part of this conversation when it comes to advertisers that advertise on Fox, when it comes to letting their neighbors know about Fox, and if nothing else, that's how you begin to marginalize Fox. That this story is in front page of the New York Times, front page of the Washington Post, front page of the Boston Globe and the LA Times is unconscionable, but it needs to become front page, because if we don't address what you have written in this article now, we are going to live to regret it, because Trump will not crawl under a rock and disappear, and Fox may find a reason for continuing the hate speech that they have learned to use so effectively.
And can I just add to that also, that is a beautiful statement, Arnie, and but possibly Don Lemon, you know, I don't think we should write off CNN as Don Lemon a pretty terrific guy, and he might take this and run with it.
So this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We've been talking to Robert Entman. He wrote an incredible piece at theconversation.com about the use of the word hate by Fox. It is a powerful piece. You need to share it. You need to reread it. And more importantly, let's check the advertisers that advertise on Fox. And also let's make sure that other media outlets point out this information. This isn't about bad conservatives. This is about the use of hate. Anyway, we will talk tomorrow. Ciao. This is Arnie Arneson. I've had enough of watching scenes with schizophrenic, egocentric.